Right now it's time to be joined by David Terachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us, of course, on a Friday morning. He is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has a terrific website, themediabeat.us. You can find him also with his Media Beat commentary here at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat, and right now we'll click on David Terachuk. Good morning, David.
Hello there. I'm glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and being once again back in the same continent as the always incisive Marshall Miles. And I return, of course, to a United States that in the last 2 weeks when I was away was rocked by mass shootings, and almost as soon as I arrived, the media are reverberating with yet another such shooting. After Buffalo and Uvalde, it's Tulsa, and now the deaths are of doctors and medical staff, plus the evident suicide of the shooter. And last night, of course, we had the head of state and government, Joe Biden, appearing on TV, one of his rather rare direct addresses to the nation in our homes. Such addresses are, of course, a classic case of the president using the so-called presidential bully pulpit. Bully, of course, is the 1990s enthusiastic slang of the first president, Roosevelt, and it means just powerful or tremendous, or if the gods of language will forgive me, awesome. It's got absolutely nothing to do with bullying. Anyway, Biden was evidently treading carefully from his pulpit. There are quite evidently not any specifically presidential measures to come, no new executive actions or directives. Instead, just urgent calls on Congress to act. You will recall, Marshall, I'm sure, he said very plainly on Monday, and I will cherish this quotation, I can't dictate this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember that. That's a line that has been pointed out by numerous people. And as a president, if you have majorities in the House and the Senate, significant majorities, you can dictate. But when you're a president that has a 50-50 Senate and a House that you only have about a 16 majority, and you have some conservative Democrats in that caucus because you got a big tent, there's very little you can dictate as president.
Sure. And journalistic reaction to the president's address has just been to stress these pleas of his for an assault weapons ban. It was he, after all, who led the fight for the last ban that expired after a decade in 2004. His other pleas, of course, have been foregrounded in press coverage today. Of course, for calling for stronger background checks on people buying guns, for raising the age at which they can be bought, for more effective red flag of warnings about gun holders with potentially mental health problems. All the usual measures that come to the fore in the media every time one of these appalling catastrophes happens. He also acknowledged, though, I mean, this is part of his treading warily, I'd put it, that it's a fact, and that's what he called it, a fact that, in his own words, the majority of the Senate Republicans don't want any of these proposals even to be debated or come up for a vote. He said he found this unconscionable, but he did recognize it as a fact, a pretty immovable obstacle of a fact. Political journalists are watching carefully to see what legislative changes on guns, if any, really will emerge this time. There's a well-meaning group, I trust they're all well-meaning, a group of senators who are working on it. And it has to be, as you pointed out, it has to be the Senate where this work happens, since it's the Senate, as that frequent sad headline has it, is the place where good congressional proposals on guns go to die. It's instructive to notice the language being used amongst these senators, especially, or notably anyway, your own Connecticut Senator, Chris Murphy, who's leading the effort. He's quoted using an allusion to a cartoon storyline, of all things, when he talks about his wariness in trying to get agreement from his Republican opposite numbers. His jarring words stick in my mind. He said, I've had the football pulled out from under me enough times to be realistic. He's referring, of course, to a running gag in the Peanuts strip cartoons. Yeah. It's one of those strange occasions when, sadly and with utter weariness, we really are confronted with not knowing whether to laugh or just to break down and cry. But if we can be positive about it, Marshall, sorry to break in again, but we might perhaps see movement about background checks or maybe the extension of red flag warnings, but I wouldn't count on it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I look at it this way, and I tell my friends, the only action that we're going to see, and it'll be a little action. People want sweeping gun control. Sweeping gun control is not going to happen. It's not with the way the politics is, and not with the way the Senate and the House are set up. But one small step at a time. If you can at least get something through the Senate, that you can get through the House. I don't care how small it is, how insignificant it might be. We need to see at least a step in the right direction as a country.
Yeah, a placard that I've been seeing held up at demonstrations in the last 3 weeks has been sort of so unspecific but so clear. Several times over I've seen it. It just says, do something. It's kind of plaintive, but I think that's where we are. We just need something done to show that something, however small, can be done. And maybe as time goes on, we'll get more confident about breaking the logjam.
People have got to tamper down, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but they've got to tamp down their expectations, because even though this is just, you look at the amount of shootings in this country as compared to the rest of the world, it's just such a big problem. But right now, as a country, we've just got to buckle down and take what we can get. You've got to get momentum going, and obviously momentum doesn't get going when people get shot, David. That's the thing that really amazes me. You've got 15, 20, 15, 12, 10, 8. I mean, what does it take to motivate senators? What does it take?
I would say, and you'll call me a cynical journalist for saying this, does it take a senator to take an action? Terror of losing his seat, that's what I'd say. Your point about momentum is important. And much of the press has taken on a campaigning feel. Let's see how much momentum can be stoked by the very strong editorials and urgent pleas, littering really, coming on display in every form of medium at the moment, from radio right through to social media online. Clearly, and the public opinion polls show it too, 83% of the nation wanting background checks, for instance. There are opportunities. There is material to work with here in order to build momentum, and we may see it. But as I think we're both saying, we can't count on it bringing sweeping change. I think it's going to be incremental change that we get, if any.
All right, are we ready for our fanfare?
Oh, I'd love to hear the fanfare. It's something we haven't used for a while. We've been dealing with such grim material so much of the time, but I want to single out some journalistic work that contributes startlingly to the public's understanding of what's going on in the world. So let's hear it. Yes. I'm singling out a cover story in The Economist this week, a publication that's no longer slavishly true to its name any more than the Wall Street Journal slavishly covers only Wall Street. Both are general interest papers, but with an inevitable tilt towards money matters. Listeners might remember that I've historically had my reservations about The Economist. For me, it can sometimes have a tone that's a bit too patronizing and a bit smart aleck, for my taste, to use a Scottish phrase, more loosely translated in the school playground, at least as smarty pants. I don't know, there are some other cruder versions, of course. But for all their tone, they often address really serious issues in a serious way. And in this magazine's dedication to loading, even overloading, perhaps, their articles with facts, they've done something remarkable this week. Partly, but interestingly, only partly triggered by the Ukraine war, they've covered very much more fully the prospects of global hunger that you and I were recently discussing, then just a few weeks into the war, if you recall. It's not just a matter of the blockading of ships off of Ukraine's southern coasts that are currently preventing Ukraine's massive grain harvest from getting out to to a needy world, but there are also the effects of extreme weather and the widespread disruption of trade internationally. All these other factors are combining to threaten famine for millions of people in some of the most food-scarce communities around the world. It's a powerful article with the Economist's usual effective graphics conveying the vital facts and figures. Well worth a read, I'd say, and a turn also to the opinion section, too, for some realistic, sensible ideas for moving toward a solution to this life and death issue. But we should talk about the war itself, Marshall. This media capital I live in and I've just returned to has been riven again this week in an all too familiar way. One of my hometown newspapers devoted... well, we know the one.
Yes.
Rupert Murdoch owns it. It's called the Wall Street Journal. We just referred to it. We used its most stentorian tones. I mean, it guested the president, but it still, on another day, accused the president of, guess what, ambivalence over Ukraine. They said in a very strong, typical Wall Street Journal editorial this week, and I quote, "It's hard to tell if President Biden and his strategist, that's a word I ought to be able to get my mouth around. It's hard to tell if President Biden and his strategists want Ukraine to win its defensive war against Russia or merely survive to sign a truce with more of its former territory now under Russian control." Well, Biden seemed like he wanted to respond directly, and he contributed to the New York Times. Another hometown newspaper of mine, an opinion article on another of those uses of the bully pulpit, I guess, to lay out his position. He and his team wrote, "As the war goes on, I want to be clear about the aims of the United States." It turned out to be a narrow tightrope that he was walking. He pointed out that, "I decided we will provide the Ukrainians with more advanced rocket systems and munitions." But at the same time, he stressed that these advanced systems were to be used, in his carefully chosen words, only to precisely strike key targets on the battlefield in Ukraine. And meanwhile, of course, his communications people, in all likelihood some of the same staff who helped him draft that article, have been intensively briefing journalists to say that U.S. policy is very firmly not to enable Ukrainians to strike beyond their own borders, not into Russia itself, in other words. The dominant fear remains that we, the West, should do nothing to provoke Russia's President Putin from escalating the conflict toward nuclear war. That fear seems to be, and probably justifiably, absolutely predominant in the White House thinking.
You know, you look at the situation, and if I'm a country and I'm invaded, I'm going to look at any way I can to show the population in that country that's invaded me that. This is war. You know, I think that a lot of people don't, except for the people that are now getting death notices from their family members, about their family members, I think most people, they don't feel the effect of war. They feel the effect of the monetary issue, but they've been through that before. And none of the Russian population has actually felt the brutality of war. I hate to say it, but I mean, that's the only alarm clock that's going to wake up Russian people, and if not, This is going to just go on like the great long wars in Afghanistan. You know, it could be a 20-year war.
Sure. Well, what's worrying the White House strategists, of course, is the fact that to give Russia a taste of the impact of real war on their own populations is almost inevitably, given all the hints. I mean, not so much hints, but very clear statements made by Putin and his foreign minister that nuclear response would be the next consequence, or the immediate consequence of anything that looked like an invasion into Russia's territory. It's the conundrum that's faced us ever since we had nuclear war, the capacity for waging nuclear war, and once again, the diplomats and the strategists have to tiptoe around this issue, and you know the weaponry used, if you like, it's not the right word to use exactly, especially when we're talking about literal explosions and radiation outfall and fallout rather, and the rest. But it's very often the weaponry involved at this stage is things like the op-ed, the propaganda, if you like, on each side, and it's. It's worth reflecting on the media role in such situations. It's not unusual for Biden, for instance, to use op-ed. It's interesting that he hasn't done much in the way of these direct addresses like last night's to the public. But he has been quite a fan throughout his career before he became president. Using newspaper editorials to signal policy and try to do that business that you're referring to of building momentum for certain policy aims. It goes back a long way with him. I remember, I guess it must have been 2003, when he wrote again for the New York Times an op-ed suggesting that Iraq be divided up into separate sections. This is after our U.S. and its allies' invasion of Iraq. And only this year, the president, back to the issue of gun violence, he wrote an op-ed in February in yet another New York paper, the Daily News in this case, about gun violence. This is after two New York City cops were killed by a man wielding a gun with a 40-round magazine. He was stressing then the need for cracking down on the flow of firearms. The op-ed is not a weapon, certainly a tool for leaders. If I can just be a media geek for a moment, I should point out that when we loosely use the phrase op-ed, it's a misnomer, and it's being dropped. It's certainly somewhat arcane and now getting very much out of date. And I've heard people call an op-ed the opinion, as if it was an abbreviation for opinion editorial, whatever that might be. It's literally an abbreviation that means opposite the editorial, because in broadsheet papers like The Times, such pieces would traditionally appear in print, at least on the page that faces the paper's own editorial columns. So the content might sometimes oppose what the paper itself is saying, but in fact, the opposite here means only the physical oppositeness, the physical placing in the physical paper. And now that many of us don't even pick up the physical paper anymore, we hardly ever, preferring to read it online, the name op-ed seems especially antiquated. The Times itself has dropped the label, and as with the president's piece this week, it calls such articles guest essays. I suppose it's nice for a newspaper to have the president as a guest. I wouldn't know. I've never guested a president. Posted a president.
I want to switch over to an amazing woman, whether you like the monarchy or not. to be
the British monarchy, I presume.
Yeah, 70 years.
I'm very fond of the Liechtenstein monarchy, but that's another issue. But I'm sure you have a serious question. Go ahead.
I do, because, you know, to see somebody that's been around for 70 years, not really a head of state, but kind of a head of a state, the monarchy. And
she's head of state, absolutely, but she's just not head of the government.
And to see the different people, leaders that she's dealt with over those 70 years, and to see the jubilee there for the 70th. You know, like I said, I'm not a huge fan of the monarchy, but I think when you have staying power like that, you're a pretty amazing person. But once again, like everything else nowadays, she couldn't attend the late service, okay? Harry and Meghan were there, and then when Bojo showed up, he got booed. So it's, you know,
it shows you the difference between being head of state and being head of government. Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's one of those things. I just think it's kind of cool that somebody can do what she's done for 70 years. That's all I'll say. What was she, 28 when she started, 26?
A very young mother. Yeah. Sure. I don't remember the actual mathematics of it, but sure. I mean, 70 years is an achievement, of course, and well worth marking. I'm troubled by the mawkishness of my own people, I'm afraid, when it comes to their attitudes towards the towards royalty, and I'm troubled especially by the broader expanse of the royal family, or the firm as it's known inside Buckingham Palace. You know, there are other generations of this monarch's family but it's just tiresome to see the press coverage about. I'll put it no more strongly than that. I don't want to be, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, especially not someone who's been parading so prominently and so steadfastly for 70 years. You're right. 70 years is an accomplishment in itself. And what do we have to look forward to? A 70-plus-year-old monarch stepping up to the throne. That will be an interesting development.
Well, I was going to say, he's been biding his time for a long time.
He's a patient man, we're told.
He has to be.
I think he has to be with a very healthy, sprightly mother.
Well, Waiting for Godot must be one of his favorite pieces of artwork. I tend, and what would be worse is if he was asked to actually not take it, and it was given to the younger one. That would be even more drastic.
There are rumblings about that very possibility, and you know, from people who do know him, I have heard it. It certainly is not something that he's prepared to allow for one second. He wants that job. He's been in training for it enough, and just recently he's been in effect practicing it. I mean, he's been doing it in real time. What's called the Queen's Speech, for instance, which lays out the government's legislation for the coming parliamentary period, and some of the events this very week connected with the Jubilee. He's been the public face and voice of the Queen herself, and heaven's sake, he's so close. It would be extraordinary if he decided it was okay to skip a generation and leave him out. That's not going to happen, I can firmly say.
All right, and I guess the final thing to look at would be what's going on in this country with the January 6th committee. By the time they get ready to decide to do something, the Republicans will probably be in control of the Senate.
Yeah, classic run-out and clock tactics. But yeah, it's a great way of delaying things. If you're under investigation, you say, "I will not respond to this subpoena." That's what's happening. The congressional committee investigating the whole event, and And it's been very determined and diligent, I think, about getting as much evidence into the pot to be stirred as they possibly can. And that involves speaking to people close to Trump and people who were communicating with former President Trump on the day itself. As they are doing, they're simply refusing to cooperate. We've got the makings of yet another logjam along the way. What's to be done if they simply say no? Well, the committee doesn't have an awful lot of power. It can refer these cases to the Justice Department for action under the heading, I suppose, of contempt of Congress. But that sounds suspiciously like a political action, and I think you've got the makings here of cries of a modern day kind of martyrdom from Republicans saying, you know, this is burdensome and unfair, and we're just not going to do it. So what happens then? The whole paragraph of eventualities just peters out into a series of dot, dot, dots.
All right. One final question for you. I had a friend that just came back from a trip where they left New York, a 20-some day trip where they went to Italy and then back. And they said they love to travel. They haven't traveled since the pandemic. But it's a real pain in the rear end to travel. I want to ask you, after your trip to Europe and your travels over the past three and a half weeks, is traveling that much of a pain?
I've actually been traveling for about 6 to 7 weeks, Marshall, and pain just doesn't capture it. I love arriving at places, and I love working in distant places, and I also love coming home. But that bit of work that you're going to do in between, the connective tissue of travel itself, is just miserable now. I'm so tired of it all that I'm making a resolution not to travel again for a while. But, you know, just watch me. I'm afraid that determination is going to peter out, and I'll get itchy feet and I'll want to travel once more.
You know, it's funny, but what you're saying blends in exactly what this person said. They love to travel. They love to visit foreign countries. They love to explore. But they did not. They did not like what went on the travel in between, and it puts a big halt on what they were planning to do again next summer. So it's obviously something that that goes even just staying in the United States and doing your hop-to-hop flights. It just seems like traveling right now by air is really, really tough.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we should think also how much carbon emissions were spewing out as we fly around. But you know, it's a difficult balancing act. I'm an international journalist, and I need to see on the ground what's going on. And I could take a boat, I suppose. These are all comparative matters. It's all a matter of proportion. I'm not intending to jump on a plane for some time.
All right. Always great to speak with you, David. We'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely.
Take care. David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. You can find David at his website, themediabeat.us, and also at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on David Tarachuk with The Media Beat.